Welcome back. This is our ninth reflection in our series on Isaiah, and I've called it, Unto Us a Child is Born. Those words will probably be familiar either from chapter 9 in this very famous prophecy of Christ, or maybe from Handel's Messiah, an oratorio that incorporates passages like this into its stirring program. I begin with the words of a very prominent Old Testament scholar. This is one of the best known messianic prophecies in the Old Testament, and in its present context, it stands as the impressive climax to Isaiah's memoirs, 6:1 to 9:7. Just as the first series of judgment prophecies, chapters 2 to 4, ended with a glorious prophecy of hope, 4:2 to 6, so now, after the prophet's terrifying vision of the heavenly court, chapter 6, his failure to convince the house of David that God is with us, chapter 7, and his final predictions of distress and darkness, chapter 8, there comes this superb dynastic poem picturing the birth of a royal savior who will establish a kingdom of justice and righteousness. Let's read the text. But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest. They are glad as when you divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, and the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult, and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. You may have noticed the first word in the chapter is but there will be no gloom. It's a bit awkward. Of course, those chapter numbers are not in the original. In fact, in the Hebrew Bible, 9:1 is 8:23. It's part of the previous chapter. So to get our bearings, let's read the last verse of the previous chapter. They will look to the earth, but behold distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish. And they will be thrust into thick darkness. But there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. So you can see how it flows there. Now, why would there have been gloom and contempt in Galilee, in the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, because that's where the Assyrians invade. These lands that lay west and southwest of the Sea of Galilee, they're the first to fall to the invading Assyrians. But it says, those people have seen a great light. Now, it hasn't happened yet, but it's being written with such confidence, it's as though it already had happened. And so this light is dawning, and this describes Jesus's ministry, of course. It's noted in the Gospel of Matthew. There's a sense of great freedom. It's not just light. It's the image of the harvest. We're going to have enough now. We'll be satisfied. It's dividing the spoil, the image of battle here. And we have a yoke being broken. We have a reference to the day of Midian. That's, of course, Gideon in Judges chapter 7, with a minute force conquering a very large enemy and great victory at a time when Israel really needed it. And I think these words would have become even more meaningful in 612, that is, in the following century, when Assyria fell to the Babylonians. The capital of Nineveh, capital city, was burned to the ground. That's 612 BC. I really like the way one fellow put it, speaking of this great sense of liberty and joy and hope. The darkness and distress are real, but they are neither the only reality nor the fundamental reality. In any given situation, we can either sink into despair or rise to faith and hope. I like that because there are a lot of times where I feel both things at the same time. I feel disillusioned or I feel discouraged, but I feel hopeful, I feel faithful at the same time. Maybe you're having a time of despair or disillusionment. Maybe life's been really hard. And yet, all you got to do is lift your eyes up and you'll see the Lord, and there can be faith and hope even in the midst of despair. That's so important so that we don't give in to despair. But it also is a very realistic perspective. God's people do not always have a great day every day. There will be challenges for us. Now we come to the most famous verse in this chapter. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Wow, what a powerful passage. It says a son is born. Well, in Isaiah, these sons are symbolic. I mean, they're real people, but they have meaning. It's really important. Think of Isaiah's three children, Shear Yeshuv, a remnant will return. That means after the exile, there will be a chance. There will be some hope. We have Immanuel, with us God. And, of course, Mahashalal Hashpaz, which is quick to the plunders, swift to the spoil. I'm not even going to try to say the name of the fourth child in Hebrew, but Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, there's a mouthful. That's a name. And it's a son. In Jewish theology, Psalm 2 and 2 Samuel 7 somehow became connected when people were writing things and doing commentaries. This was well before the time of Jesus. 2 Samuel 7 is speaking of the son of David, this eternal kingdom. And Psalm 2 speaks of whoever becomes the king, whoever accedes to the throne, becomes God's son. Now, we don't think of it that way. Your prime minister, your president, you don't say, oh, yeah, that's God's son. That's the son of God, or that's the daughter of God. But it's the way these things were described at that time, that the king was adopted and he became God's son as he began to rule. So this, the sense of a son coming would be very encouraging indeed, especially learning that he's a wonderful counselor. He brings us godly wisdom, not worldly wisdom. Follow him. Do what he says. Mighty God. This king, this messianic figure, is divine. Everlasting Father. He's not going to leave us as orphans. Think of Jesus, John 14:18. Prince of Peace. He's not a violent monarch like so many world leaders today. He's a descendant of David. His kingdom is characterized by justice, as any government should be. And it's a kingdom that will last forever. So this is not, I mean, there's no one in the Old Testament who matches the bill. Now, this prophecy was still left unfulfilled when we move into New Testament times. We understand it as Christians that it was fulfilled in Jesus Christ. In fact, the hope has to be transferred to the Messiah because the physical kings just won't do it. The Assyrians almost snuff out the dynasty of David, right? They get the northern kingdom, Ahaz and his son Hezekiah. It's a close call, but you know, the kingdom of Judah lasts a little bit longer. But then the Babylonians do snuff out the dynasty of David. So it's not as though political Israel is going to be the medium through which salvation comes to the world. It will come through a descendant of David, a son of David, so to speak, the Messiah. But it's not going to come politically. We don't need to worry about that. This is the Prince of Peace. His ways are not the ways of the world. And this will be accomplished by the zeal of the Lord of hosts, that is the true armies, the heavenly armies. And zeal is a characteristic of God. Here we see it in chapter 9. It's also in chapters 37, 42, 59, and 63. Well, this must have been very encouraging, a great oracle to hear. Yet despite the bright future, don't rejoice prematurely. In fact, be sober, because we're going to swift back now from a hope oracle to a doom oracle. Verse 8. The Lord has sent a word against Jacob, and it will fall on Israel. All the people will know, Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, who say in pride and in arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen, but we will build with dressed stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will put cedars in their place. But the Lord raises the adversaries of Rezin against him and stirs up his enemies, the Assyrians on the east, the Philistines on the west, devour Israel with open mouth. For all this, his anger has not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. In the previous chapters, Isaiah has been preaching to or against Judah, the southern kingdom. But now it's alternating. We're back to Israel, the northern kingdom. It's Ephraim's turn. Again, Ephraim, one of the largest tribes in Israel, the northern kingdom. And the word will fall on Israel. The boom comes down. Keep going. The people did not turn to him who struck them, nor inquire of the Lord of hosts. So the Lord cut off from Israel head and tail, palm branch, and reed in one day. The elder and honored man is the head. The prophet who teaches lies is the tail. For those who guide this people have been leading them astray, and those who are guided by them are swallowed up. Therefore, the Lord does not rejoice over their young men and has no compassion on their fatherless and widows, for everyone is godless and an evildoer, and every mouth speaks folly. For all this, his anger has not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. You know, God punishes sin. He takes this seriously, but he is providing a second chance. It says the people didn't turn to him who struck them. They didn't inquire of him. They should have, in their pain, just being smart, they'd realize, oh, we need to turn to God. They're like the image in chapter one, that body, that person who's just a single bruise from head to toe, who's just taking a beating, a pounding, and won't humble himself. God's blows can be redemptive and rehabilitative. The opportunity shouldn't be wasted. It says that God cut off Israel, the Lord cut off Israel in one day. Maybe possibly that's referring to the day that Israel fell formally in 722 when the capital city of Samaria was destroyed. He indicts the elders and the prophets. The elders are honored. They're wise in their own eyes, however. They misadvise the kings, and the prophets are telling lies. Isaiah is not talking about Micah and Hosea, and he's not talking about the true prophets. He's talking about the establishment prophets. And there were many, and they outnumbered the true prophets throughout the Old Testament. And these people, like many preachers today, just say what people want to hear. It's just lies. It's so tragic because the result is war. The Lord doesn't rejoice over the young men. The young men are the ones who are mainly dying in the wars. But the widows and orphans are also affected. It's always the children and the women who get the rawest deal whenever there's a war. But interestingly here, and I think it's the only verse in the Old Testament like this, orphans and widows are targeted in this doom oracle. They're godless also. Just being in a tough situation in life doesn't make you a martyr or give you some kind of exemption. Still need to follow the word of God. But instead of that, there's godlessness and evil and folly. And that folly, everyone speaks folly. That's the kind of vileness that we find in characters like Nabal in 1 Samuel 25. Someone who just won't listen to reason. A practical atheist who thinks that life can be lived without God and his words are relevant to our practical concerns. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. For wickedness burns like a fire. It consumes briars and thorns. It kindles the thickets of the forest and they roll upward in a column of smoke. Through the wrath of the Lord of hosts, the land is scorched, and the people are like fuel for the fire. No one spares another. They slice meat on the right, but are still hungry. They devour on the left, but are not satisfied. Each devours the flesh of his own arm. Manasseh devours Ephraim. Ephraim devours Manasseh. Together they are against Judah. For all this, his anger has not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. This sounds even more intense, does it? We've got this crackling fire. We've got this dense smoke moving up. The land is scorched. and people are turning against each other. Internal strife, civil unrest, anarchy. Each devours the flesh of his own arm. It doesn't mean people are, that would be stupid. You know, I'm hungry, so I'll eat my own arm. But God's people are biting and devouring one another, to take a phrase from Galatians 5. Manasseh devours Ephraim, Ephraim devours Manasseh. So they don't really like each other very much, but they know they don't like Judah, where Jerusalem lies. And who's responsible for this? It's mainly the leaders, the leaders. Finally, let's read in chapter 10. Woe to those who decree iniquitous decrees, the writers who keep writing oppression, to turn aside the needy from justice and to rob the poor of my people of their right, that widows may be their spoil and that they may make the fatherless their prey. This is the seventh woe. A few talks ago, I mentioned seven, but you notice there are only six. They're in chapter 5. This is the seventh one. It just comes a bit later. And this is a woe against leaders, lawmakers, governors who write laws that are unfair. They institutionalize injustice. Each enactment brings more grief for the poor. They view the nation as their personal fiefdom. I know I said that before, but I'll say it again. They want to enrich themselves. They're not humble. They don't care for people. They're totally unlike the Messianic king who will one day come, the one we just read about in chapter 9. They make the fatherless their prey, widows. You know, Jesus said the Pharisees, a lot of the Pharisees, they love money, and they would devour widows' houses. And what does that mean? I think it means they would become close to those widows and benefit from them financially when they died, or they would get them to give their money to the temple. This is just wrong, just wrong. We had that refrain, for all this his anger is not turned away, his hand is stretched out still, just in case we missed it. That's the fourth time in our reading. I would like to wrap up with some applications, but first, a final quote from an eminent scholar. How very far from the future that the leaders had in mind. Fall is the last word of the line and recalls the same verb in 9:8. Okay, this is me, Douglas, explaining. 9:8 said the world would fall on them. In chapter 10, it said that nothing remains but to crouch among the prisoners or fall among the slain. That is, the rich people can't take their wealth with them. They've got a choice. They can either be prisoners of war or they can be killed. Fall is the last word in the Hebrew. Okay. To refuse the revealed word may well seem an irrelevance in the real world of construction programs, 9:10, political maneuverings and superpower imposturings, 9:10, of prominent civil and church leaders, 9:15, or average human wickedness, 9:18, and government mismanagement. But in the long run, it's the word which falls, 9:8, and those who reject it fall among the slain. What about application? Well, I have four thoughts. Human governments will fail us. They do fail us. As Christians, we don't need to be flustered. There is a righteous sovereign, the King of Kings. One day he will rule with perfect wisdom, care, and justice. Let's look forward to that. Second, we can have hope, even amidst despair. The two aren't mutually exclusive. We can feel one emotion inside the other. And we should have hope, even when things are hard. Don't waste the opportunity. Something good can come of it. Thirdly, concern for social justice in the Bible is a big deal. We've got to care about this. Leaders need to care. Government should care. Fourthly, speaking of governments, don't be overly impressed with human power. God is infinitely more powerful than man. Trust him. And our next reflection, entitled Rod, Axe, Fire, Shoot, Signal, and Sing, we'll be looking at the rest of chapter 10 and all of 11 and 12. God bless. Have a great day.